It is April the 24th, 2009, and Nancy Peroso is interviewing Mr. Harold Hari, and at his home in Winnipeg. And perhaps, Mr. Hari, you could start with your early remembrances of the grain industry in Thunder Bay, where you grew up, even perhaps before you started working in the industry.
Well, I originally started with Searle Grain, which is no longer in existence, but they had a terminal in Thunder Bay located out at the Mission, and I was working in the office, and I really wasn't too familiar with the grain industry up till that time, and then became a learning experience. From there, I stayed in Thunder Bay until 1964, and then I transferred to Winnipeg to go into the marketing department, with still with Searle Grain, which eventually became Federal, which eventually sold out to the Pools. So, I wound up with when the pool sold out.
Now it's just the record thing again, and yeah, we should be off and running.
Okay.
We just had a brief interruption while we waited for our coffee to perk, and you had started to talk about your early experience with the Searle elevators, or Searle elevator in Thunder Bay. So you didn't have any family then that worked at the elevators?
No, I didn't.
Before you
no.
started? No. So how did you end up with a job at Searle?
It was just an opening. Came actually through the unemployment insurance group at that time. I was I'd worked for a year at a wholesale down there, but I wasn't overly happy, so I left there, and an opening came at Searle Grain, and so I applied and been in the grain industry ever since.
What was life like at the Searle elevator?
Well, I worked in the office, and it was a privately owned company, but the boss, his name was Les Irwin, they made a habit of treating their employees fairly well. For instance, during the winter, they were reluctant to let any of the lay off any of their men. They tried to make work projects for their men all winter long to keep them employed year round, and they had a very good record of having a 12-month a year staff employment for most of them. So the atmosphere was good. Mr. Irwin was a pretty tough boss, I must fess up to that, but overall the staff treatment was pretty good.
When you say a tough boss, what?
Well, he had his own way of dominating things. It was his way or the highway, and so we pretty much had to toe the line with him.
Was he from Thunder Bay himself?
Yes, I believe so, yeah.
Do you know anything about the history of the Searle elevator?
Well, the company originally was founded by A.L. Searle, that's all we knew him by, but it was always just strictly a family business, family affair. And his sons were Stuart Searle, and they became managers and CEOs of the company, so it stayed right within a family organization up until the time they sold to the Federal Grain. It was taken over.
And what was the work that you did in the office?
It was I was chief clerk down there, and it was pretty much keeping track of the record keeping between audits. They had physical grain audits at least once every year and a half, and it was one of my responsibilities was to keep track from audit to audit as to what had happened, the gains or losses, and try and put a dollar value to it and that kind of thing. So. And then it was the handling of the paperwork required for the movement of grain in and out of the terminal, both by rail car and shipping out by vessels. We had regular communication, of course, with the lake shippers down there. They used to phone with the boat orders, and our responsibility was to make sure all the orders were filled properly and instructions given to the plant accordingly. It was fairly routine work. That's why I was very happy when I got the opportunity to go to Winnipeg. I was got into the marketing area, and in reality, you don't really know anything about the grain industry per se in Thunder Bay until you come to Winnipeg, where the marketing is done. And that's where you find out about the grain industry and what causes the grain, different types of grains to be moved. And it opened a whole new world for me. It was really quite an eye-opener.
Before we move to your work in Winnipeg, I just want to go back a bit to the life at the elevator. When we were taking our little pause earlier on, you had mentioned something about the staffing of the elevator and the work crew was made up largely of Italian.
It was a very large Italian segment in there, yes, and they did most of the bullwork. It was the shoveling boxcars in those days, a very, very difficult task. It was a hard job, and that was essentially a lot of what they did. And then, of course, they got involved in the terminal operations, the cleaning of grain, the drying of grain, and so on. And one thing that the Searle staff did, they had a very stable management crew or operational crew in the plant itself, like the department heads in the plant. They were there for years and years and years. They spent their whole lives just at that Searle grain. So it was a very stable environment from that direction, from that perspective.
Do you remember some of the names that were involved in the?
Watt Gray was a foreman, Ron Hicks, and Harry Turner was the millwright, and Charlie Lawrence was an electrician. Stan Hunt was an electrician. Yeah, lots of old, good old folks that worked down there. Yeah.
And you had mentioned the Commisso name.
Well, he was really stayed pretty much as a laborer, pretty much his whole career. And the Italians, we found one thing about them that they spoke Italian, and many of them spoke very little English, in spite of being in Thunder Bay for years and years. They could very great deal of difficulty communicating with them. And but Mr. Commisso was just pretty much stayed in the labor work and right in the terminal itself.
So father, son, history throughout with the
Not
laborers, or?
necessarily. It was mostly relatives that came over from Italy because it was an opportunity for them. I guess he had to guarantee them some kind of work or something to come over here, and they all congregated at the terminal, and many of them stayed there for years as just within their own little community. Even when they went back home, a lot of them lived right in the Commisso residence, which was on Syndicate Avenue, right across the old Ogilvy elevator. So there was always a bunch of them around there. Yeah.
The Searle elevator, you mentioned, was on the old mission
Yes.
site. So you were next door to.
Yeah, it was the National Grain or Grand Trunk Elevator, we used to call it in those days. It's now a Cargill terminal, but the two of us were out there, kind of isolated from the rest of the grain terminals, because there was, in those days, a bunch of the smaller elevators were in the river, Cam River, and the big terminals were at Intercity and at Current River. The big terminal, Saspool 7, was at, and still is at, Intercity. And our terminals were kind of mid-sized, not the biggest, but still far from being the smallest. We had quite an efficient terminal at Searle, and they were very progressive. They were always trying to develop new dumpers. They were very instrumental in developing the dumpers for cars at one time, and before long, this was the days before they used hopper cars for the grain, which was a great innovation for the trade, by the way. Those hopper cars, they were extremely efficient and a lot less labor intensive.
Could put a lot more cars through the system.
Yes, and with a lot less impact on the labor force.
Was there any communication between the elevators, or were they pretty independent?
They pretty much operated within their own bailiwick. Even like Saspool, they owned several terminals down there, and I think their staffs stayed fairly stable within the elevator. If anybody worked at Pool 7, they were pretty much at Pool 7 for their careers. And no, there wasn't a great deal of communication. It was all kind of monitored through the lake shippers. They would be responsible for allocating vessels to terminals and that kind of thing. And through the Grain Commission, of course, that their function was to control the quality and the weights and grades of the grain that went in and up both in and out of the terminal. So, but the interplay between the terminals, it was just trying to contribute to the efficiency of moving the vessels out of there. And they were all pretty anxious to get as large a shipping as possible, because that was the key to moving grain. That many years the terminals were close to capacity, so they needed the heavy movement by grain by vessel to create the space so they could handle more cars.
Now, you said, if I recall correctly, that you came to Winnipeg in 1964.
That's correct, yeah.
And so you would have been, when do you recall when you started at Sur Malaria?
1948.
1948, so right
Yeah.
after the war then.
Pretty much, yeah.
So you were there over the time that the Seaway opened.
Yes,
Did
yep.
that create any changes that you saw?
Well, it wasn't quite what they'd expected. They had a great amount of publicity over the opening of the Seaway. It was essentially a big thing, but the vessels that were able to navigate the Seaway in those days, they came up and they were entirely different vessels from the lake freighters. Lake freighters are big bulk vessels, and they would just open the holds and drop the grain in, and the grain terminals would just move them back. But the ocean-going vessels, they're all comprised of many small compartments, and the grain terminals, it was a whole special stevedoring job just to load the vessels, and very slow. This was a very surprising and disappointing element when the first ocean-going vessels came in there, because they'd be tied up at a dock there for 2 days just loading the vessels. And whereas in, for the same amount of grain, it would be gone within a half a day or a day from the big terminals down there. So it was exciting to start, but after a while, the terminals weren't that excited. They'd sooner have had a laker in there rather than an ocean-going vessel because of the speed that they could move the grain out. It was very interesting, but eventually the ocean-going vessels became a little more adaptable, and they grain trimmers, the stevedores, they became more knowledgeable with how to load the grain and whatnot, so it became more efficient. But in the initial stages, it was not too exciting from a terminal standpoint.
The Searle Elevator went through some changes in ownership. Was that while you were there? Or
No, when I left there, it was still Searle Grain. When I moved to Winnipeg, we were still Searle Grain. And then while I was in Winnipeg, I worked for them in Winnipeg until 72. And then that's when they sold out. They became Federal Grain. They partnered with Federal Grain at the time, which was also a privately owned company. And they stayed intact until 72, when they sold out to the Pools. And at that time, I could have stayed on with them, but then they were going in a little different direction within the new company. So at the old Federal Grain, they stayed in business, but they got out of the grain business. They went in Federal Industries. So I wanted to stay in the grain business, so I went with United Grain Growers, and I worked with them in Vancouver for a year and a half in the sales department. And then an opportunity came along for with Sask Pool for the grain sales manager, and I was fortunate enough to get that job, and it was a great thing. I very much enjoyed working for Sask Pool. They were a good company to work for, good people to work with, and it was the best thing that happened to me in my grain career.
a little earlier on in the conversation, you made a really interesting comment about it wasn't until you moved to Winnipeg in the marketing end of things that you began to realize more about the grain industry, where it was a much more narrow focus in Thunder Bay. Can you expand on that a little?
Yeah, in Thunder Bay, when like all, we know the various kinds of grains, we know what goes to the boats and one thing, but we had no idea what was causing it, what grains were being loaded, where they were going, why they were going, who was getting, who was using them. It becomes a functional or an operational thing down there of just moving the grain in and out without any idea of who's responsible, why is it necessary to load barley this week and oats next week and some of your red spring wheats, you know, in the other vessels. And some of them would go to the bay ports, some of them would go down. The bulk of the grain moved to the St. Lawrence River for transfer to elevators down there for eventual shipment overseas. That's where most of the grain went. And we didn't really know or really have any appreciation for that end of it in Thunder Bay. We were just interested in moving grain in and out. So when we get to Winnipeg, we got into the marketing area, and then you find out, you differentiate between domestic grain usage and export grain usage, and who gets it and where it's going and why it's going there. So it was real eye-opener and really very interesting.
So is it possible to give us a representation of what a grain marketer's job was by thinking of a, you know, what would be a normal day in a grain marketer's life?
There's no such thing as a normal day in a grain marketer's life. It depends. There's so many areas. First of all, there's the wheat board operations, and there's they handle like the bulk of all of the export grain, wheat and barley, that goes out of the country. And they're the ones that do all the buying and selling, all that. Those are the board grains, and then the open market grains, the domestic grains, the oats and barley, they would go down east for feed, and the canola and flax and rye, those were what they call open market grains, and those were the grains that we marketed. Particularly the emphasis was on canola, and as the years went by, the rapeseed became canola, which became a very, very large open market grain, and it's very significant today in the productions. The researchers did some wonderful work to create a very desirable product. The canola oil now is well recognized worldwide for its quality. And so the production accordingly has increased considerably on the prairies. But we were involved right from the start when it was called rapeseed and the trading of the rapeseed. And I was involved with the futures market. And that's a whole separate study in itself. There were really very few people outside of the industry that understood the futures market trading. In fact, there were many people in the industry that had difficulty with it because it was a whole separate study. But that was the open market grains. The board grains, of course, they didn't trade. They traded in Chicago markets as wheat, the bulk wheat, which establishes the world price for the wheat. But the board was responsible for all the export of wheat and barley, plus the wheat that was used for domestic flour milling in this country. And that's still the scenario today, and this is where the dispute comes in now about should the board have control, and it's a whole political issue right today, and it will continue to be for some time.
Do you have thoughts on the issue? Yourself?
Oh, very much so, and I don't want to get too much into the political end of it, but I've always been a supporter and a believer in the wheat board, and as long as the farmers are of a mind that they would like and prefer somebody to do their marketing, there were many farmers that were very good farmers, but they had no interest and no desire to learn the marketing end of it. That was not their bailiwick. But they were very good farmers. They could produce good wheat. And so for those people, the wheat board concept was good because the wheat board can get prices for them, which are recognized the world market price. But there are other farmers that, in particular this day and age, a lot of the younger ones, they become university educated, they become knowledgeable in futures trading and marketing, and they would prefer to market their own. And one of the difficulties is trying to work the marketing, the flour milling, the wheat into the States, because that's a whole different market down there, the flour mills in the States, as opposed to the wheat production that, or wheat usage that's done in Japan and Europe and on a worldwide basis. So you have to measure the benefits of what the farmer wants, whether he wants to let somebody else do his own marketing. And it's the gap is closing, but it's still the majority of farmers, I think, are wanting the wheat board approach. And I'm still of a mind that I've always liked it, and I think it performs a useful service for the farmer.
When you were doing the marketing, did you interact with the wheat board at that time?
No, my responsibility when I was in charge of the marketing with SAS Pool was the open market grains.
Okay.
So my main contact with the wheat board was for the malting barley, because the malting barley is still handled by the wheat board. They originate all the sales, but then we sold the malting barley to the users eventually down in the state, mainly in the States. But we also had malting barley customers over in Japan, China, and whatnot that we would work with, but that was my area. So I interacted with the board insofar as was necessary to move the grain. But as far as the sales, my involvement with the board was very little.
When you said your area was malting barley, were you also marketing other grains?
Just the rye flax and canola.
Okay.
And there's another area too, which is growing, is the special crops. But that again is another whole ball of wax. And I was not involved at all in special crops. You need people that are well versed in that area to get involved in it. But it becomes part of the movement. One of my responsibilities with SAS Pool, and then eventually with XCAN when I was served with them briefly, was because of my knowledge of Thunder Bay. I got involved in the movement of the grain through Thunder Bay. We sold it, but we would arrange for the usage of terminals in Thunder Bay that were specially designed to clean the oil seeds or handle the malting barley and that kind of thing. So we became of a mind that we had to use the terminals in Thunder Bay as a means to an end rather than our daily responsibilities. It was one of the arms that we used to cause the movement of the grain to be effective and the sale of the grain to be effective from our perspective.
Now, when you say our perspective, was that with XCAN or when you were working with
Cyril as well? The way it worked, I was with my career is with SAS Pool went after I got back to Winnipeg. But then XCAN became the marketing arm for the three pools. And we, of course, worked very closely with them in the marketing of the grain. And then eventually, towards the end of my career, we developed an integrated marketing program for canola. And I went over to XCAN at about 3 years before I retired to implement or develop a marketing program, which eventually was incorporated, and then I was responsible for the movement of the grain from the three pools through XCAN at that time. But the bulk of my career was with SAS Pool and then working with XCAN eventually as they developed into the marketing arm, the export arm.
A couple of questions come to my mind based on what you were saying earlier. First was that you would contract with elevators that were able to handle, I think oil seeds was what you had mentioned. So did various elevators specialize in different products.
Some terminals were unable to clean oilseeds because it's a special type of cleaner. So we had to direct the movement of flax and canola into terminals that had the cleaners that were specially designed to handle those. And it was an ongoing problem both in Thunder Bay and in Vancouver because originally the terminals weren't well equipped to clean canola out there, and the demand became much larger than what the terminals were capable of putting through physically. But eventually they developed cleaners and installed cleaners that were very sophisticated, and they were able to move large volumes of canola through. And I think pretty much in Vancouver now most of the terminals can handle the canola quite well. In Thunder Bay, there's so few terminals left going, I imagine all of them can handle canola now in varying degrees.
When you market on behalf of your company, do you make sales calls? How does somebody market their grain?
Well, you establish customers, in those days, it was done by telex. A lot of the grain marketing was, we were in sales, but it's not like you have to sell something to somebody. What is the selling point generally is the price, because the quality is the same. You sell 1 feed oats, or you sell malting barley, 2CW, 2-row barley, or that kind of thing. And the grade is established by the Grain Commission. So the quality is not in question, it's just a question of price. So a lot of what we did was very much price related, reading markets and trying to establish or project whether the markets are headed for good, better prices, or whether we're going to have an oversupply, watching the crop in Canada and worldwide to just determine what the price is going to do. So it was pretty much a price-driven kind of operation.
And therefore, the commodities exchange was a big part of it.
Very much so, yeah.
So, how would you watch the quality of the crop and the changes in the market? Was there research done within the marketing division?
Well, most of the companies had people that were just almost on a day-to-day basis as the crop was coming along and watching the weather very closely. As you get near frost season and things like that, the big impact frost has on the quality of the grain. How much rain you had, is there sufficient moisture to produce a good crop? Is it going to be large? Is it going to be small? It's all the factors that go into whatever creates a price. And many days, a little session of bad weather will create a throw scare into people, and the price jumps pretty quickly. And then it turns around, the sun comes out, and the price drops just as quickly. And that's the nature of the market. And you get used to it after a while, but it takes a long time to get used to to roll with the blows, if you will. Yeah.
Sort of just what farmers have to do, but on a much bigger scale.
Very much so, yeah. They have to always have to decide what kind of a crop are they going to plant this year, what are the market prospects, how long is the season. Like this year, they may be late planting crops, that this again is going to affect the kinds of crops they put in, because their maturity days are different for different kinds of crops, and very much the same as what the farmer has to face every year.
Did Searle have its own network of elevators at Country Elevator?
All the companies did. The terminal companies all had their own line of elevators, right, spread across the prairies. And the Saspool had a very large number of Country Elevators. They were the largest handler of grain. But the whole picture has changed so much now. It's interesting when you drive across Saskatchewan to see all the big inland terminals that have been constructed, and slowly by slowly, all these small little elevators, which sustain so many of the small towns, have been dwindling, closing up, and just no longer functional. They're not economical, and these bulk handling terminals are very efficient, and which has led now to the movement of unit train kinds of operations. They have 25 car loadings, 50 car loadings at some of the bigger inland terminals that create a much better efficiency in the system for moving grain from the country, because when it lands in the terminal, you can move them through very quickly. You don't have to, in some cases, don't even have to clean it. You just put it in, just move it, bring it in, and ship it out when the vessel's ready.
Had they started that consolidation when you were still working?
Yeah, so it the inland terminal concept really was just well getting going around the time that I retired. There were a few scattered around through the years, but they were never really used to much degree. And one of the problems with the rail system in those days was trying to service all these small country elevators, and it created a great deal of inefficiency in the movement of grain. Now, when they have the larger bulk handling terminals from a railway perspective, it's much easier to move grain and get a much quicker turnaround time now with the cars. The turnaround time was very slow in those days, because you can imagine going to a small country elevator point to get the car spotted in the first place. Take a day to load the car, and then the railway would have to come in and then hook it up eventually with a train that was going to Thunder Bay or Vancouver or wherever it was headed. And it was quite an inefficient system of moving grain, which has been very much streamlined today, and they can move grain much more efficiently and much more effectively today.
Are there any losers in that system, would you say, or is it a win-win for everybody?
I think it's pretty much a positive situation. Anytime you can contribute to an efficiency of moving grain, probably the biggest drawback is the farmers have to move their grain much farther now to a central gathering point. In the original days, I think all the elevators were, or every farm had an elevator within 10 or 15 miles of its location, but now it's not considered unusual for a farmer to haul grain 40, 50 miles to a terminal. But they have such big vehicles now, and efficient vehicles, that the big impact now is maintaining the roads to handle all these big trucks. But it's a different aspect of moving the grain. So the biggest impact is probably the distance a farmer has to travel to the terminal.
You mentioned a word that I've heard often and yet I've never asked anybody to define it. Spotting a car. So it doesn't just mean seeing it.
No, not quite. It's railway terminology, and they have to move a car or cars into position where they're going to be able to access it for the spouts that are used at the elevator, and they have trackage. And every elevator has a different length of trackage. Some can only handle 4 or 5 cars at one time. Others now, with these unit train loadings, they can handle up to 40 and 50 cars. So the trackage that you put in for these terminals, and it's a lot of space. Cars are sizable, and it takes a lot of space. So the original trackages for these, they'd only load 1 or 2 cars at these small country elevators in some instances, so you didn't need a lot of trackage to accommodate the cars. But now the trackage and the maintenance of these trackages is very significant.
So I'm sort of bouncing around a little bit here with your career, but you, Searle, you worked for when you moved into Winnipeg, and then there were some changes.
They merged with and became Federal Grain, and we operated as Federal Grain, I think it was 1967. And then they stayed in operation until 1972, which is when they sold all their assets, their grain assets, to the pools. And it was the three pools were involved, Alberta and Manitoba and Saskatchewan were involved in that. So
And you were still in the marketing division then when you were with the
I was in marketing in Winnipeg, and then when I went to Vancouver, it was in what they call the sales department in Vancouver at that time with United Grain Growers.
Oh, okay.
And so I've been involved in the sales of grain ever since I moved to Winnipeg.
Any differences in working with different organizations, or was it different office but same job?
Mostly the personnel, the people, the managers that were running the companies and one thing and another, but no, it was just the different philosophies, I think, for the pools, like Sask Pool. Of course, they were all the pools are very supportive of the wheat board type of operation, whereas the independent grain companies, they were probably more inclined to get involved in the marketing of the open market grains kind of thing. But by and large, it became a case of who the managers were and what kind of daily routine you went through, what the atmosphere was like in where you worked. But philosophically, the big idea was to buy grain and sell it at a profit.
So, was there any difference between working in Winnipeg and working in Vancouver? Being so much further from where the product was grown, did that make any
Well,
difference?
Winnipeg is really the headquarters for the world marketing grain on a worldwide scene. Vancouver, you're just focusing mostly on the Orient and specialized customers and the movement of the grain. The movement of grain in and out of Vancouver is quite a test because the rail situation out there is limited because the layout of the city. Some terminals were on the north side of Burrard Inlet, some on the south side, and even today, the spotting of cars on the north side it's quite a movement going just across from the south side of Burrard Inlet to the north side. But the focus of the grain movement is concentrated just primarily going to the Orient. So, and then you get the odd shipment going to South America, but primarily that the difference is you're focusing on a different selected group of customers.
So when you became familiar with the terminal elevator operation in Vancouver, and you'd already been familiar with the same operation in Thunder Bay, any differences in the way they operated?
Not primarily, because essentially they all operated under the guise of the Canadian Grain Commission. They were controlled on the way in, both grade and weight, and they were controlled on the way out by the Grain Commission, weight and grade. And so the operations of the terminals themselves, they took in dirty grain, they cleaned the grain, they had to dry it where it was necessary, and the function of the terminals were very much the same, whether Thunder Bay, Vancouver, or wherever.
You've mentioned a couple of times the work done by the Canadian Grain Commission. How did that impact on your work? Was that a positive thing, a negative thing, a little bit of both?
It's positive in that when you supply a product and get a what they call a certificate final from the Canadian Grain Commission, it's recognized worldwide that you're getting a quality product. Many companies, I'm sorry, countries sell based on samples, and samples tend sometimes not to be as representative of what the final product is, not deliberately, but it just happens because of different flows of grain and so on. But the Grain Commission provided you with a standard that when you sold a particular grade of grain to a customer, you didn't have to worry about any quarrel from the customer insofar as the quality of the grain is concerned. And the weights, they control the weights as well. So it was, again, primarily a pricing exercise. You're dealing with marketing and primarily price.
Did your marketing have any travel involved with it, or?
Not really. The Most of my travels were primarily company oriented, back to Saskatchewan to meet with groups in Regina or throughout the province of Saskatchewan, talking to regional managers, but it's all operational things. And the one area that we found that the people in Saskatchewan were eager for information about the futures market, but really didn't understand much about it. So much of what I did was traveling through Saskatchewan, was conducting meetings at various locations to explain the futures market to our customer, farmer customers, and they just cut it off.
Like when you were, sorry, shall we start up again?
Okay.
So we took a little break there, and now we were talking about the travels that you were doing, and you had mentioned that a lot of your travel was internal to Canada. So you, just so that I sort of keep things straight here, when you moved out to Vancouver, it was with UGG.
That's correct, yes.
Now, one thing I wanted to ask about UGG, because I've interviewed other people about it, and I've done a little bit of reading,
he was well-known, well-respected through the trade, yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It almost, I have the impression that UGG was sort of a bit of a hybrid. It was sort of a pool, but tended to be a little bit more to the private company perspective as well. You worked both in UGG and Saskatchewan Wheat Pool. Was there any difference in your mind about the two companies?
Yes, you're quite right. The three pools, they were very heavily oriented to the wheat board and the board movement. And many of them didn't really take the time to understand or want to get involved in the open market grains. Whereas the UGG were still supportive of the board, but they were much more inclined to try and divert into the open market grains. But you're quite right, they were more oriented, geared to the private trade as opposed to what the pool philosophy was. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So following along your career, and you moved to Vancouver and worked in the sales and marketing there.
That's right,
with
yes.
UGG. And then what was the next step?
I got the opportunity to come back to Winnipeg as grain sales manager for SAS Pool, and that was in 1974. So it was the I finished my career then with SAS Pool, and then with that little changed over to Excan towards the end, as I explained before. But that's when I really got into, I was responsible for the overall open market grain sales for SAS Pool. And that's really when all the doors opened for me as far as getting involved in the grain industry. And it really didn't involve traveling to meet the customers. The only customers essentially were malting barley people that we would go down to meet down in Minneapolis from time to time. But I only went overseas once, into Korea and Japan. And that was towards the end of my career, and it was as much to get familiar with meet some of the Japanese customers, the Oriental customers, because we went to Korea and went into China, and it was maybe as much a PR thing as it was a sales venture. But as far as the traveling for sales, you know, all my traveling was pretty much operational within Canada.
So when you said that you when you came back here to Winnipeg and worked with Saskatchewan Wheat Pool, that's when all the doors opened. So
yeah.
How did your job differ then? How did it expand?
Well, it was the responsibility for the buying and selling, essentially, of the open market grains. We established the prices as to what we would pay the customers, and this would be done on a daily basis and always based on the futures market. This is what the futures market did. It indicated which was why a futures market was established in the first place, is to establish a true market value. So all of our buying and selling was done based on the futures market. And then our involvement with the futures market was such that whenever we made purchases from the customers, we would the next day hedge it, go and sell corresponding futures, and this is how we protected our purchase from a decline in the market value. And so we used the futures market extensively in my operation, and this would be just on the buying side. Well, then the counterpart to that is we have to dispose of the product, so the judgments come in then as to the timing, establishing a price, how much you sell, how far ahead you sell. Many times grain would be sold for purchases 6 months down the road, 6 or 8 months down the road. So without a futures market, you cannot establish pricing values. You have to use the futures market to protect yourself on the sale that you make. But essentially, my responsibility was to buy from the customer, bring the farmer customer as large a return as the market warranted, sell it out, and at the same time try and realize an operating profit for the organization. So it was the buying and selling of grain, trying to keep our head above water. Mostly successful, but not every year. Some years was pretty tough.
Yeah, so that was a challenge of the.
Always. Yeah. It was fun.
To a certain kind of person.
Yeah, you have to be geared to marketing.
Yeah. So did you actually trade on the floor yourself,
No,
or?
I was not involved in the trading of the futures. All we did was give the orders to futures brokers. And I was responsible. We had a man that traded on the floor, and he did our trading for us. But I didn't really go on the trading floor itself and do the buying and selling. You used to see pictures of guys screaming and hollering and waving their arms, but I was never involved in that part of it.
So, the name of the fellow that did your trading for you, do you recall his name at all?
Bob Stats was our main salesman there for years with Sasspool, and George Reed eventually took over part of that marketing the grain and in the futures market. Yeah. And they didn't really do a lot of buying and selling themselves in the pit. They used mostly used futures brokers, people that did this for a living.
A very specialized group of people, I
Very
understand.
specialized, yes.
Yeah. The speaking of the commodities exchange, then there's been changes in that. I don't know how much you've kept up with that.
Well, that's an understatement because the whole picture has changed now. This all happened, of course, after I left, and they've gone right into the electronic trading. Now everything is done by machine, and there's no such thing as people standing in the marketplace and hollering like there used to be in the old days. It's quite a different perspective. And then, again, now this reflects the idea that price is everything. What this is what you're doing is you're buying and selling based on price. And this is where all the trading is done now. And so the commodity exchange exists in by name, but it per se, it's really not what it used to be.
Do you see any impact of the sale of the commodities exchange, the moving of a lot of the markets actually outside of Winnipeg?
I've been away from it for a while now, but from what I've been able to tell, no, it's always been a pricing game. You're buying at the best price possible and trying to sell at a profit, realize your margin. You always try to gear to get your terminal to at least realize their elevating margin. That's what keeps them viable. And if you can make some margin over and above what their elevation fees are, then you're that much ahead of the game. But the objective always was to keep your terminals active and to make sure that they got their elevating revenues.
So it almost seems that the advent of computers and the electronic transfers then almost lends itself to the type of transactions that were done, and they could be done anywhere in the world, essentially.
Yeah, essentially, that's for sure. The ones that are impacted were the poor guys that were the futures brokers, and they used to make a pretty good living on buying and selling futures, but that portion is pretty much vanished, you know. Mm-hmm.
So 1974, if I've got my years correct, started with
SAS Pool, yep.
And you stayed there for the rest of your career.
Yeah, in Winnipeg here, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And when did you retire?
1994. It's just about 15 years now since I've retired.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So mm-hmm. 20 years of.
Yep.
With SAS mm-hmm. Weed Pool, changes in the weed pool over that time.
Oh, this whole picture changed so much. It's actually, they were doing so much changing at the time that I retired that it was both within SAS Pool, within the industry, there were a whole host of things that were changing, different elements of how the grains were handled, perspectives from with the wheat board and with the grain commission, qualities, concerns, and there were so many changes going on all at once. This movement to the inland terminal thing in the country, specialized products moving out, bulk or unit trains moving from the west, a lot of them bypassing Thunder Bay, going direct down to the river ports. There was some of that unit train movement going on, and when I retired, that was really a good time to get out of the grain industry because so many changes were happening, and mostly within SAS Pool at the time, the whole concept had changed now. So it was a good time to retire.
When you say the whole concept had changed, yeah. Can you be a little bit more specific there?
Well, it was SAS Pool, which was really much board oriented. Now it's become just a very private grain trading company now, and they still have facilities which they use, but these facilities are used for marketing their grain and to their benefit and their profit.
So there was a move even at the time in 1994 then when you were retiring, there was a movement towards the getting out of like the farmer ownership aspect?
No, not per se, not when I was there. No, it was just mostly a change of personnel at the time that was involved. And so the people I worked with that were really such good people, and a lot of them were starting to retire about the time I did, and it was really a good time to get out because there were new people coming in, and they had a little different approaches to things, a little more worldwide approach, some of which, to my mind, contributed to some of the problems they had eventually, but that's a whole different load mm-hmm. of poles. So,
so how would that happen? Like that they can contribute.
Well,
to the problem.
Some of the philosophies seemed to be such that they wanted to try and get established on a worldwide scale that become a very large international handler and grain trader, and the concept may very well have been sound, but it was just the degree going at it perhaps a little too much too soon sort of thing, and it I think contributed to some degree to how they were able to or had to really get out of some of these grain handling facilities in Europe and that kind of thing, which was really quite divorced from what SAS Pool was originally set out to do.
Grain handling in Europe, how does that
Well, there was a lot of it was happened after I left, and I don't know much about it, but there was some terminal facilities that they undertook to take into Mexico and down in and into Europe, that they had a grain handling facility there, and it was theoretically quite conceivable that it could be done, but it somehow it just didn't really all seem to work out. Mm-hmm. And again, that was long after I left, and I'm not even sure where they stand today on those.
Yeah, I wasn't aware of that. So you'd mentioned some of the personalities that you worked with. Who sticks out in your mind as
Well, the CEOs of SAS Pool, and then the presidents, like Ted Turner was a great president for them. Ira Mumford was a good CEO for them. Milt Fair was a very significant person. These are all Saskatchewan people, of course, and but very capable people, very level-headed, very fair people. Always good people to deal with, you know. We Merv Ryan, who was my immediate boss in SAS Pool, he always had a philosophy for the grain marketing. He says, or operations. He says, there's no such thing as a bad decision. He says, some are not as good as others, but you always his key was you have to make a decision. Yeah, but he was a good, really good guy. You always felt that if you played square with Merv, you always got a square deal with him. He always treated you very fairly, and but very capable, no nonsense kind of operations man. Good man for the company.
any others that stick out in your mind as being
Well,
special
I
people?
worked with Jim McDonald here in Winnipeg, and he was a good individual to work for. He was technically my boss because I was located in Winnipeg. I worked primarily in country operations, but I did get involved in terminal operations because of my background. And Jim was the terminal manager, so but he pretty much left me to conduct the operations. He didn't really dictate what I was to do or how to do it. He just says, "Do it." And I very much like that free rein to be able to handle the things the way I thought should be done effectively.
I'm just taking a look at some of my questions here, and we've covered an awful lot of them. I just wanted to ask something about the carriers that you mentioned very briefly, the railroads. Did the work that you do put you in contact with the railroads, or was that another?
No, I really didn't have any dealings with the railways. I knew the railway people, and it was very minor any involvement I had with the railways. That was pretty much left in the hands of the transportation people. And
Special group
yep.
within the organization. We've talked about, just as we went through the various aspects of your career, we've talked about the changes. Are there any changes that you haven't had a chance to talk about that occurred over the length of your career?
Not really. I'm not really. You kind of caught me unawares there. I
No,
can't really think
you
of
know,
anything
and I think
else.
it's because you've covered them. Just to give you some of the, we've talked about the changes in markets and products over time. I think we've covered that. Changes in competition. I don't know that we specifically dealt with sort of the competitive nature of the business and the changes that might have occurred over time.
The competitors tended to stay pretty much the same through the years. We have the same people, the Cargills and Continentals and all these others that you're both dealing with and at the same time doing business with, because many of their export arms operated at arm's length, and we could make transactions with them, without impacting on their internal operations as well. We used to sell, buy and sell with Cargill and any number of areas. They're such a large organization that we were bound to get involved with them in many ways. And so we had a lot of interface with many of the large exporting companies. And
So they would act as your agents then? Is that
no,
how
they
it?
would be customers. We would
Oh.
sell to them, and they in turn would sell to users, end users in other areas.
And that would be through the commodities exchange that would take place, or would it be sort of.
Not necessarily. They would buy grain for purchase, like what they would call a on a CIF basis. It was if you bought grain in CIF Rotterdam, it means that we would have to supply a boatload of grain in Rotterdam with the costs covered up to that point, and then from that point on, that's where they take ownership of the grain. And they would cause it to move to end users from that point.
So CIF stands for?
Cost, insurance, and freight. It's
Oh,
just a
okay.
term to establish where the location and what's covered in the price that you sell to the customer in
So
time.
they would actually sort of call you or telex you and say, can
There's
you provide this?
well, there's many terms for in trading. If you sell FOB your terminal, well, you load the grain to the terminal, you get paid for it, and from then on, it's the exporter's responsibility.
And FOB stands for?
Freight on board, right on at the terminal point. You load it onto the boat, and then you're done. But if you're responsible for freight, then you have to deliver the product to the customer, but you have to cover your insurance for the transportation of the commodity to the product to the port. And it's just a term that's used, very common, CIF and FOB. And so we always lay these out when you make your offers. There's different expressions that are tied in with that, but essentially it's just to establish who is responsible for what costs at what point in time.
And the insurance, how.
Ocean insurance, it's for vessel insurance. If something happens to the vessel, it gets caught in a storm, and then the grain or the commodity goes down the bottom of the ocean. Well, somebody's got to pay, and that's insurance.
Yeah. Did that ever happen in your time?
Not to my knowledge.
Yeah. So who provides the insurance? Was it self-insurance and.
They have companies worldwide that provide insurances on these kinds of
So it'd be
things.
like the Lloyd's of London
Yeah.
kind of.
Yep.
Good. Shipping. Did you have any connection there?
No, again, there were departments that are set up in export operations that deals only with ocean-going traffic. They're watching rates, positions, availabilities, timing, and we only sold on certain terms, and then we would arrange for a freight, but not really dealing with directly much with the ocean-going companies. No, no, no.
Because of one of the focuses of the project is on the port of Thunder Bay, could you comment on the sort of the changes that you've seen in that port over the extent of your career?
Well, the biggest impact originally, so much of the export grain from Canada moved out of the East Coast, went down through Thunder Bay, through the river ports, transferred, shipped to ocean-going vessels, and moved to the customers, and very much in Europe and the Middle East. But through the big transition through the years was Europe became more self-sufficient, and the worldwide markets became such that the end users started to develop in the Middle East and in Asia primarily, so that the focus then became moving the grain from Canada into Japan, China, and users like this, and which then brought Vancouver into play. So the movement of grain started to shift, going from focus going out of the east as opposed to the main thrust going out of the west coast. So that impacted so much on Thunder Bay, on the movement, because there's still a small, comparatively small tonnage goes through Thunder Bay for domestic use in eastern Canada, feed grains and domestic or flour milling. But the movement to the terminals in the St. Lawrence River has been much diminished because of the locations of the customers on the world scene. So that was the biggest change from through the years from then till now, if you will, that the worldwide locations of our customers for Canadian grain.
That shift in the market, both the logistics of it and the players, did that have any impact on your work, or it didn't really matter, whether you had a customer in Japan versus one in Algeria?
Well, it depended on the product. Like my area, one of the big items, of course, always was canola, and then the demand for canola was always steady, and Japan was a big user. But then we had other customers going out of the West Coast, and but there were times when we had a pretty significant movement of canola going out of the East Coast as well. So that would go through Thunder Bay. So it was a direction. And where was your canola located? Were you in the eastern portion of the province or the western portion of the province? And where do you draw it from? And what are the different costs for positioning the grain to move to these various customers? So that it was that was one of the areas was in the canola that caused us to look at geography of where the grain was grown.
Changes, this usually comes up, changes in the crow rate. Did you see any shift in operations?
I think we'll pass and I can delete that one. I have some thoughts on that, but that was really out of my bailiwick, was the
Yeah.
crowing thing.
Yeah, everyone seems to have their
Yeah.
thoughts on the crow rate
Yeah.
and significant changes in many
Very
instances.
much so, yes.
This is sort of a broad question. And because you work for different companies, maybe difficult to answer, but what is your sense of the role that your work and your company or companies played in Canada's success as an international grain trader?
Well, that's kind of a tough question to answer. We were always trying to get the best price for the producer. That was the objective of our whole modus operandi, if you will. What are the best means to achieve this? And as far as contributing to that, I think we were flexible enough through the years, for instance, to move with the canola movement, going out of the West Coast, getting better cleaning facilities established, all of which contributed to the canola has become such a large part of the grain producing area now that I think all of us played a kind of a small role in working towards that end. How much of a role that was is, it's hard to say, but we were always trying to work towards getting the best price for the producer. That was our theme. And I think essentially we achieved that to a fairly significant degree.
And the success of the international grain trade is very dependent upon the success of the individual farmer, because if you don't have successful farmers, you don't get the product
That's the
to
name of the
sell.
game. Yeah, one of the beneficial movements through the years has been the establishment of the International Grains Institute, and they're bringing people in from all over the world on a continuing basis. Have done for years. It's been a very successful operation, and I think what you're doing is making customers around the world aware of your product, what you're able to supply, in what volumes, in what direction, what qualities. And I think that played a significant role in helping Canada's grain industry and the farmer.
Did you have any special involvement with the Grains Institute?
I was not involved directly, no, but I've always been a strong supporter and strong believer in it. attended a course, one of the main courses they had there early on. So I was always a firm supporter and tried to promote it whenever I could.
A couple of questions just specifically about your career. What do you think it takes to have a successful career and survive in the work that you did over the years? Skills, knowledge, personality, traits?
That's kind of a tough question to answer, but I think the most important aspect is dealing straight up with people, with customers, with fellow employees. You always get different degrees of cooperation from various people depending on what their motives are. But through the years, I found that if you take a straightforward approach and deal on a forthright basis with people and with customers or with fellow operations people, then it pays a lot of dividends in the long run. Sometimes the short term, you're tempted to do cut corners, but you try and control that as best you can. And I always try to be straightforward with people, and developed a lot of very good friendships through the years based on a lot of trust.
Do you think that those skills and the knowledge that you have, do you think that those still remain the necessary skills and knowledge for people working in the industry today?
Oh yes, I don't think that perspective ever changes. It's still a case of people dealing with people, and you have to have faith and trust in the people you're dealing with, and be able to take them at their word. And if you don't, sooner or later it catches up to you. But I think those qualities have to stay. That's one thing we always found with farmers. They always were very straightforward, and there's no nonsense with them. It was just, and we tried to reflect that characteristic right through all of our trading operations.
The question I always like to ask is, what are you most proud of in the work that you did?
I guess I would just have to say that through the years I felt we were able to achieve what we were challenged to do, to do the best we could for the producer, try and spread as much knowledge of the industry as we could. And I think, to my mind, I was always comfortable with that we gave it our best shot to achieve that end.
Good. Just to ask a couple of general questions, are there any questions that we should have asked you that we didn't?
You've asked me just about everything that I think you could ask.
The other has to do with our project in a bit broader scope. The birth of this project was in a little bit broader idea. We wanted to, a group called the Friends of Grain Elevators in Thunder Bay, wanted to commemorate the grain industry and its importance to not only Thunder Bay but Canada in preserving an elevator, a terminal elevator in some fashion or another. It seems like that might be a dream that we can't accomplish, but if we do, are there certain aspects of the elevators or the Canadian grain industry that you think are important to preserve for people to understand it now and in the future?
Pretty tough to answer just offhand. That's something that I'd have to think about for a while. I'm not really sure quite should or shouldn't be incorporated. I think that's one I'll, for the moment, I think I'll have to pass
Yeah, well, I'd
on.
really like you to, if you get a chance, to take some time and think about it, because we'd appreciate knowing. One of the things I think that you mentioned that comes to my mind is that in Thunder Bay, the people that work there are very focused on what they do and don't necessarily see the big picture. I certainly, as a, Thunder Bayer, didn't. And then on the other end, with the farmers, that they were somewhat similar, although things probably, are changing, in that they were interested in getting a good crop, and then when they delivered it to the elevator, that may have been all that they saw, but the whole industry is so much,
Very much so,
so
yes.
much more.
One item that we didn't talk about perhaps is the number of terminals at Thunder Bay. This is what you're involved in, is the elevators at Thunder Bay. And at one time we had over 25 elevators operating down there, and some of them not very large, but they were, there was quite a number of them. And all the ones in the river, I think, are pretty much closed now, and they're down to probably six or seven elevators that are still working down there. But it's I think an indication of how the elevators have probably been streamlined so that they are capable of handling more grain in a more efficient manner in less time now than what they ever used to be able to. So that's one significant change in this whole industry since I started it.
You were, was it 1948, did you say,
Yes,
that you
that's
started?
correct, yeah.
So you were there for at least one of the grain explosions or the elevator explosions. Do you recall that at
The
all?
one at Grain Growers was the bad one, and I'm not really sure that happened maybe just around that time, maybe just before I was even there. I'm not really sure. I can't quite remember, but that was the bad one. Was the one at UGG, was the one that comes to mind anyways, and yeah.
And do you recall, like, what do you recall hearing about it?
Oh, it was, well, very prominent, of course, in those days. It was front and center with everything we talked about for a while, sure.
Any stories related to it that stick in your mind? There's very few of the people, that were involved that are actually around to talk to about.
Well, it led to a lot of research into the hazards of grain dust and the explosive potential of grain dust. And I know our boss was very much involved through the Industrial Accident Prevention Association, I think they were called, and they did conducted all kinds of experiments with dust, just on scale models, to see what whether it was something along the line of that grain dust that could have triggered that explosion. And I think the efforts were because of those made to try and reduce the amount of grain dust and the conditions that caused, potentially could have caused the explosion. And I think going by results in recent years, I would have to say that some of those experiments must have proved somewhat successful, because there hasn't been the same kind of incident as, to my knowledge, anyways.
The that industry safety organization and the tests that they were doing, were those tests, where were they done? Were they done in Thunder Bay or elsewhere in the
Well, they
world?
were, I think, if I can recall, they were just kind of done scale models kind of thing, just to, and I'm not sure where they were done. I can remember seeing they used to have meetings annually down in the States and all over the place, and I'm not sure how large these experiments were or how significant. I've only seen little models of things that they were using to kind of reflect conditions that might happen, but I really didn't get involved. I couldn't comment on the quality of those experiments.
The little models, did you see them in Thunder Bay, or were they?
Well, it was just a scale model of a terminal, essentially, and yeah.
I'm interested. I'm glad that you mentioned that because I, we were thinking of tracking down some information about that. So I'll track down that organization.
It could be long gone by now. But.
Could be, exactly. Yeah. Well, there may be some record somewhere.
Yeah.
And we're talking about little scale models and things. And other questions we have here are: do you have any memorabilia, including pictures, that you would like preserved to commemorate the history of the grain trade and your part in it?
I wouldn't view my part as anything significant. No, I don't really have anything.
And no pictures or?
I don't think so. No.
Okay. And I think this is the final question, and that is, are there others, you mentioned Mr. McDonald, that you feel we should contact to interview to get their part in the big picture?
Well, it depends what, you know, if you're just focusing on Thunder Bay. I don't, there are a number of people that could possibly help, but offhand, I wouldn't want to volunteer any of the names right now.
Perhaps we should say our official thank you, and we can talk more about this once the tape is over.
Fair enough.
And I really appreciate your taking the time to speak with us today. Your story was a very important one for our project.
Nice talking to you.